Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
An Ever-Reddening Glow by David Brin, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Read by Jean-Paul Garnier. We were tooling along at 4 nines to sea, relative to the Hercules cluster, when our captain came on the intercom to tell us we were being tailed. The announcement interrupted my afternoon lecture on basic implosive geometrodynamics, as I explained principles behind the Fulton star drive to youths who had been children when we boarded, 8 subjective years ago. In ancient science fiction, I had just said, you can read of many fanciful ways to treat the limit of the speed of light. Some of these seemed theoretically possible, especially when we learned how to make microscopic singularities by borrowing and twisting space-time. Unfortunately, wormholes have a nasty habit of crushing anything that enters them, down to the size of a Planck unit. And it would take a galaxy-sized mass to warp space over interstellar distances. So, we must propel ourselves along through normal space the old-fashioned way, by Newton's law of action and reaction, albeit in a manner our ancestors would never have dreamed. I was about to go on and describe the physics of metric surfing when the captain's voice echoed through the ship.
It appears we're being followed,
he announced.
Moreover, the vessel behind us is sending a signal, urging us to cut engines and let them come alongside.
It was a microscopic ship that had been sent flashing to intercept us, massing less than a microgram, pushed by a beam of intense light from a nearby star. The same light, thoroughly redshifted, was what we had seen reflected in our rear viewing mirrors, causing us to stop our BHG motors and coast, awaiting rendezvous. Picture that strange meeting, amid the vast, yawning emptiness between two spiral arms, with all visible stars crammed by the Doppler effect into a narrow, brilliant hoop, blue along its forward rim, and dark red in the back. The Fulton was like a whale next to a floating wisp of plankton as we matched velocities. Our colony ship, filled with humans and other Earthlings, drifted alongside a gauzy, furled umbrella of ultra-sheer fabric. An umbrella that spoke.
Thank you for acceding to our request,
it said, after our computers established a linguistic link.
I represent the intergalactic core of obligate pragmatism.
We had never heard of the institution, but the captain replied with aplomb.
You don't say. And what can we do for you?
You can accommodate us by engaging in a discussion concerning your star drive.
Yes? And what about our star drive?
It operates by the series implosion of micro-singularities, which you create by borrowing space-time metric using principles of quantum uncertainty. Before this borrowed debt comes due, you allow the singularities to recollapse behind you. This creates a space-time ripple, a wake that propels you ahead without any need on your part to expend matter or energy.
I could not have summarized it better to my students.
Yes?
The captain asked succinctly.
So?
This drive enables you to travel swiftly in relativistic terms from star system to star system.
It has proved rather useful. We use it quite extensively.
Indeed, that is the problem,
answered the wispy star probe.
I have chased you across vast distances in order to ask you to stop.
No wonder it had used such a strange method to catch up with us. The COP agent claimed that our BHG drive was immoral, unethical, and dangerous.
There are alternatives,
it stressed.
You can travel as I do, pushed by intense beams cast from your point of origin. Naturally, in that case, you would have to discard your corporeal bodies and go about as software entities. I contain about 1 million such passengers and will happily make room for your ship's company if you wish to take up the offer of a free ride.
No, thank you.
The captain demurred.
We like our corporality and do not find your means of conveyance desirable or convenient.
But it is ecologically and cosmologically sound. Your method, to the contrary, is polluting and harmful.
This caught our attention. Only folk who have sensitivity to environmental concerns are allowed to colonize, lest we ruin the new planets we take under our care. This is not simply a matter of morality, but of self-interest, since our grandchildren will inherit the worlds we leave behind. Still, the Star Probe's statement confused us. This time, I replied for the crew. Polluting? All we do is implode temporary micro-black holes behind us and surf ahead on the resulting recoil of borrowed space-time. What can be polluting about adding a little more space to empty space?
Consider,
the COP probe urged.
Each time you do this, you add to the net distance separating your origin from your destination.
By a very small fraction, I conceded. But meanwhile, we experience a powerful pseudo-acceleration, driving us forward nearly at the speed of light.
That is very convenient for you, but what about the rest of us?
The rest? The rest of whom?
The rest of the universe.
The probe insisted, starting to sound petulant.
While you speed ahead, you increase the distance from point A to point B, making it marginally harder for the next Voyager to make the same crossing.
I laughed. Marginally is right. It would take millions of ships, millions of millions, to begin to appreciably affect interstellar distances, which are already increasing anyway due to the cosmological expansion. The Star Probe cut in.
And where do you think that expansion comes from?
I admit that I stared at that moment, speechless, until at last I found my voice with a hoarse croak. What? I swallowed. What do you mean by that? The COPs have a mission. They speed around the galaxies, not just this one, but most of those we see in the sky, urging others to practice restraint, beseeching the short-sighted to think about the future, to refrain from spoiling things for future generations. They have been at it for a very, very long time. You're not having much success, are you? I asked, after partly recovering from the shock.
No, we are not.
The probe answered morosely.
Every passing eon, the universe keeps getting larger. Stars get farther apart, making all the old means of travel less and less satisfying, and increasing the attraction of wasteful metric surfing. It is so easy to do. Those who refrain are mostly older, wiser species. The young seldom listen.
I looked around the communications dome of our fine vessel, thronging with the curious, with our children, spouses, and loved ones, the many species of humanity and its friends who make up the vibrant culture of organic beings surging forth across this corner of the galaxy. The COP was saying that we weren't alone in this vibrant enthusiasm to move, to explore, to travel swiftly, and to see what there was to see, to trade and share and colonize, to go. In fact, it seemed we were quite typical. No, I replied, a little sympathetically this time. I don't suppose they do. The morality probes kept trying to flag us down, using entreaties, arguments, and threats to persuade us to stop. But the entreaties don't move us. The arguments don't persuade, and the threats are empty as the gaps between galaxies. After many more voyages, I have learned that these frail, gnat-like COPs are ubiquitous, persistent, and futile. Most ships simply ignore the flickering light in the mirror, dismissing it as just another phenomenon of relativistic space, like the starbow, or the ripples of expanding metric that throb each time we surge ahead on the exuberant wake of collapsing singularities. I admit that I do see things a little differently now. The universal expansion that we had thought due to a Big Bang is, in fact, at least 50% exacerbated by vessels like ours, riding along on waves of pollution, filling space with more space, making things harder for generations to come. It is hard for the mind to grasp so many starships, so many that the universe is changing. Every day, year, and eon that we continue to go charging around, caring only about ourselves and our immediate gratification. Once upon a time, when everything was much closer, it might have been possible to make do with other forms of transportation. In those days, beings could have refrained. If they had, we might not need the BHG drive today. If those earlier wastrels had shown some restraint. On the other hand, I guess they'll all say the same thing about us in times to come, when stars and galaxies are barely visible to each other, separated by the vast gulfs that we of this era short-sightedly create. Alas, it is hard to practice self-control when you are young, and so full of a will to see and do things as fast as possible. Besides, everyone else is doing it. What difference will our measly contribution make to the mighty expansion of the universe? It's not as if we'd help matters much if we alone stopped. Anyway, the engines hum so sweetly. It feels good to cruise along the red line, spearing the starbow, pushing the speed limit all the way against the wall. These days, we hardly glance in that mirror anymore, or pause to note the ever-reddening glow. Come Back Earlier by Jean-Paul Garnier, with music by Fog Machine, read by the author. I'd made a mess out of the whole damn thing. We never set out to fuck up, but more often than not, we do just that. In this case, the asinine element was my motivations to do good. Right the wrongs, I had cried, waving the flag of my own misguided morality. I was no stranger to screwing up, but it had been a long time since I had. My moral compass had been guiding me in the right direction ever since I woke up and realized that I'd been an asshole most of my life. Ever since that moment, I had made a tremendous effort, slowly at first, until it became habit to do the right thing, to be kind to everyone. Leaving judgment behind is a difficult thing until you've finished judging yourself. Your present self, that is. The old me would have to remain an asshole in the gutters of the past. At least, that's what I thought for a long time, always critical of how I had lived my life. But in my strides towards self-improvement, I went back to school and tried to do all the things that my younger, idiot self had claimed he wanted to do. It was going rather well for a change. I was excelling in school, I had great friends, and it seemed at times that I was truly able to leave behind the life I had lived full of regrets and self-loathing. I even smiled on a regular basis. Being kind and solid felt good. When you know your own boundaries, you tend to break those of others less frequently. Self-improvement indeed. In less than a decade, I'd gone from strung-out, deadbeat musician to the scientist I had dreamed of being as a boy. I even met a girl. That didn't pan out as well as some of my other attempts. Yet happiness seemed to be within reach for the first time in my mostly unhappy life. When I finished school, I got my first real job. One that I wasn't allowed to talk about. With my new set of values, it was hard to have to keep a secret from my friends and family. But I was working on real scientific problems, doing something meaningful for the first time in my life. Anyway, they understood, and no one held it against me, but they sure were curious. They would often tease me about being a secret agent. Little did I know that that was in the cards, too. Not espionage by any means, but rather clandestine, since we couldn't let the world know what we were up to. The government wanted it bad, and paid handsomely, too. We knew that they would want to weaponize time travel, but our team couldn't let ourselves think about that, not with a breakthrough on the way. Not when we were so close to answering one of humankind's greatest questions. And we figured we'd find a way to put safeguards in place, or string the project out and keep our employers in the dark about the real power we had harnessed. So we thought. They were on to us. It wasn't their first rodeo. Instead of axing us all, they brought us deeper into the fold. At this point, we were expendable at best. They figured the best way to keep us from talking was to make us the subjects of their clandestine time war. Their rationale was as follows. You made the machine. You do the dirty work. We agreed rather than having our baby stolen from us. And so, after all, through my attempts at self-improvement and attempts to do something constructive for the world, I was going to have to be an asshole again. Not for self-righteous reasons this time, but for what they called the greater good. Shit, I wasn't a spy, and I didn't think that I was cut out for the job. But when I told them that, they started listing off all kinds of rotten things from my past, assuring me that I was exactly the kind of man they needed for the work at hand. And so I went back in time and did all kinds of horrible shit. Stuff I would have never thought to do on my own volition. I didn't even want to ask for the reasons for some of the tasks they set me to. They wouldn't have told me their rationale anyway. Nor was I allowed to talk to anyone else on the team about what we were doing. The secrecy pained us. We had all set out to do something good, and now we were unfit soldiers in a secret time war. A war of which we did not know the reasons or possible outcomes. All my progress towards being a good human being was being undone. For the first time in years, I found my self-loathing return. My hatred of myself grew with every ill deed they bestowed upon me. This awful change inside was not the only effect of our tampering. The changes were subtle, almost imperceptible at first. More homeless on the streets, things being more expensive, particularly food. They were the types of changes that we've grown jaded to seeing, so it took me a while to catch on to the cause. There was no way to correlate our work to the things I was noticing, but my suspicions grew with each minor adjustment. Revelation snapped inside of me. Things would begin to change exponentially. No matter what the outcome, we didn't have the right to screw with timelines. We didn't know the half of what was really happening. Were we creating alternate universes by creating paradoxes? Did our current world actually change, or did we move into new ones? No matter how it was going down, it couldn't be right. Everything inside me spoke up, screamed out that what we were doing was absolutely wrong. And it was my damned fault. I had made a mess of everything, done things that my soul would not be forgiven for. It was beyond hurting people. I'd messed with the fabric of the cosmos itself. I hadn't learned anything. I'd been fooling myself that I understood what empathy meant. But through my self-loathing, the answer began to paint itself in lucid clarity. And the opportunity came. All they wanted of me this time was to divert a pedestrian and make sure they crossed the street at a different intersection. Easy enough. Maybe they didn't want the guy hit by a car or something. Who knows? I had stopped trying to understand their reasoning a long time ago. Little changes could have big effects. And bizarrely, big changes could sometimes result in similar outcomes. I stood on the street corner waiting for my mark, and thinking about what I had become, then unbecome, then become again as familiarity rose inside of me. The smell caught me first. A lackluster car wash on a filthy street corner boasting an old banner that read, "Re-Grand Opening," and had for years. The shriek of bus brakes. The holler of an old drunken veteran down on his luck. I was home. Home 20 years ago. A place I had never liked and fueled my poison-like prison mentality. My eyes left my mark and traveled up to the second story of a building half a block down. A pirate flag swayed in the smog. The same Jolly Roger I had flown for years in my pitiful single room that served as cell in those days. It flashed upon me, and I knew what to do. The door only needed a slight kick to open. I never had to worry about forgetting my keys back then. I looked at the old familiar mailbox overflowing with junk mail. The creak of the steps brought back waves of memories. Times I had to drunkenly crawl up the two flights. The swagger of striding up them for the first time to my first place without roommates. The nostalgia evaporated as I passed by a one-time neighbor that acknowledged me, but never looked up to see how much older I was. It was easy to believe that decades hadn't happened. I was getting distracted. I had to end this atrocity now. There was no way I could take down the corrupt government that had caused me to blaspheme against causality, but there was something I could do. That kid sitting in that apartment was going to cause all of this someday, and I had to take him out before he did. Apartment 108. I was about to knock, then tried the handle instead. I rarely locked the door in those days. That is, if this was before I had my guitar stolen. Apparently it was. The door swung open, and I saw him sitting on the small couch in the far corner. A draft of swagweed and cigarettes circled the room. He, or I, didn't even look up as I entered. I knocked the needle off of the record on the turntable. I had long since bored of T-Rex. Only then did he look up, his eyes darkened to shark hue. He got up slowly, looking at me funny the whole time. The look on my face couldn't have been much different. But I was also looking around the room, taking in all of the details I had long since forgotten. I knew I was going to kill him, but I hadn't considered how. As he stood up in front of me, I realized that I also hadn't considered how different we were. He was a good 60 pounds lighter and mean. Unafraid, he advanced slowly. He stared like a fool. I knew everything about him. He couldn't possibly recognize me and didn't give a damn who I was. I had invaded his space. Still a pet peeve of mine. He had that look of someone fed up, of someone who had encountered this situation before. And I remembered that indeed he had. My palms clammed up. I hadn't taken into account that I was much more fit back then, or that he was seeped in violence in those days. Would be ready for me. I lunged, and he gracefully evaded me. I fell into the couch he had just risen from as a cold wave of pain rose up my back from a solid kidney shot. Damage flashed behind my eyes. My stomach turned. I span around and met his hard gaze. He was smiling, but it fell away as my fist found his solar plexus. Breath rushed out of him, but he wouldn't go down. He parried with a quick 1-2. I tasted blood coming from my nose. This little bastard had no idea of the damage he would do. The wounds he was inflicting were nothing compared to his future, my past. My rage melted into clarity. I landed a jab on his mouth. Again, he smiled, bringing a knee up into my ribs, which cracked audibly. Now I couldn't breathe, and he took full advantage. My mouth opened and closed, but took in no air. I was keeled over, and barely saw his signature uppercut coming. Then stars. Vision returned, first as a dot in the center of blackness, then fading in slowly. He stood above me silently. I grabbed the back of his knee, pulled him down on top of me. We rolled in a death embrace, hands on each other's throats. I released my grip and returned the favor of the kidney blaster. He grunted as his eyes sharpened. I struck again in the same spot and could taste the possibility of besting him. In that moment, my confidence clouded my judgment. Could I really beat my younger, harder self? I looked into his eyes and saw the bafflement of recognition. He mouthed something, but no words came out. Then he brought down his forehead in a death blow. First the crunch, then the blackness descended, and I was finally free from time. For now. In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard An Ever-Reddening Glow by David Brin, with music by Red Blue Black Silver, and Come Back Earlier by Jean-Paul Garnier, with music by Fog Machine. Theme music by Dane Lesko. Out now, Simultaneous Times, Volume 1, Paperback Science Fiction Anthology, available at spacecowboybooks.com and lulu.com. Be sure to visit us at our store in Joshua Tree, California, or at spacecowboybooks.com. And connect with us on Instagram or Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the program. And now a word from other fellow Joshua Tree podcasters.
We live in a very weird place. A dry and mountainous land of poisonous creatures and desert monsters, missing tourists, and strange lights in the sky. Join us every Friday at 10 p.m. for a late-night voyage across the mysterious Mojave Wilderness on KCDZ 107.7.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Are you looking for a new way to think and transform? Tune into Myth Matters, a biweekly podcast of storytelling and conversation about mythology and why it's important to life today. Find a more creative way to live. Learn more at mythicmojo.com and keep the mystery in your life alive.
Have you ever wondered why people live in the desert? I'm Dawn Davis, and I host Desert Lady Diaries podcast. It's a weekly conversation with women who found their home in the Mojave Desert. Each week, I talk to women who were either born and raised in the desert or felt called to come here and what the desert means to them. You can learn more about the podcast and listen at desertladydiaries.com.